Welcome to Fridays with Fintellect. My guest today is Jessica Davis, President and Principal Consultant at Insight Threat Intelligence based in Canada. Jessica is an internationally recognized expert on terrorism indicators, women in terrorism, illicit financing, and intelligence analysis, and is also the president of the Canadian Association for Intelligence and Security Studies. Jessica spent the first 17 years of her career in the Canadian security and intelligence business, starting in the Canadian Forces and then transitioning to roles at Global Affairs Canada, FINTRAC, which is Canada's FIU, and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. Jessica is also a non-academic affiliate with the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security and Society, and an associate fellow with both the Global Network on Extremism and Technology and the Royal United Services Institute. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to Fridays with Fintellect.
Thanks, it's a real pleasure to be here.
So Jessica, the situation that is unfolding in Afghanistan is obviously a major concern today. What impact is it likely to have on global terrorism? And what, according to you, should be the longer term considered response by the international community?
From a counterterrorism perspective, the situation in Afghanistan is so complex. So basically what we have right now is an organization, the Taliban, which is a listed terrorist entity in many countries that has assumed de facto control of a state. So this obviously complicates aid delivery, relationships with Afghanistan. There's so many levels of this that we can unpack. So now you basically have a terrorist entity in control of a country and all of their resources. I want to unpack that a little bit, though, because I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding about what it means when the Taliban takes over Afghanistan. So, you know, a lot of people will say that it means that the organization has now assumed control of a tremendous resource base, which is true, but they also have assumed a lot of responsibilities in terms of monetary and fiscal policy, delivering services to Afghanistan. They have to fund their fighting force to maintain control over Afghanistan. They're also facing opposition from a number of groups, including other terrorist organizations and other militant or opposition groups within Afghanistan. So it's not quite as simple as saying that the Taliban is now taking control of all of this. And I think that the parallels that we can draw with ISIL in Iraq and Syria are important here. Yes, ISIL in Iraq and Syria had a huge revenue base for any terrorist organization, but they also had tremendous expenditures that really ate away at their profit margin. So that's sort of the Taliban piece of it. And that was a really quick gloss over of the complexities there. The other piece, of course, are the other terrorist groups that are operating in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, of course, is top of mind. They have a strategic relationship with the Taliban. I would say that relationship is going to evolve over the next couple of years. It'll be interesting to see what they end up doing. You know, when the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, to a certain extent, got one of its strategic objectives. It now has safe haven. It can operate with relative impunity. So what does that leave room for the group to do? Well, it's a terrorist organization with a strong interest in attacking the West and Western interests. So my money would be on them reverting to that activity. How the Taliban can control or influence that, though, is a question, because if the Taliban gives Al-Qaeda free rein, that will draw some very serious international repercussions. So there's a bit of a pull and tug there between those two organizations. And then, of course, I'll just touch briefly on ISIL Khorasan province, obviously getting quite a bit of media play over the last couple of days with their big attack in Kabul and follow-on attacks. I think ISIL KP is probably the number one counterterrorism problem in Afghanistan at the moment, just because they don't have a lot to lose. So they're not constrained by the Taliban and to the same extent that Al-Qaeda is. They're actively in opposition to the Taliban. So their focus will likely be on continuing attacks in Afghanistan, which is very much to the detriment of the Afghan population, because their number one targets are the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and civilians. So this is sort of the situation that we see in Afghanistan. We could probably unpack this for the entirety of the podcast, but that's sort of the high level thing. And from a financial perspective, the only thing that I'll say is all of these groups have sufficient resources to be conducting operations in the short to medium term. A lot of them are, they're all drawing resources from Afghanistan proper, which makes the counter-terrorist financing options more limited, especially when we don't have any counter-terrorist forces on the ground. It's really restricted to that military or kinetic action or targeting external financing mechanisms like movement of funds or how they're storing and managing those funds.
Right. So Jessica, in one of your articles written about 8 months back, entitled Rethinking Global Counterterrorist Financing, you have argued that there needs to be a rethink in the follow the money approach and a broader scope for CTF policy and practice. What would be some of your recommendations to international bodies such as the FATF, which is the standard setter for AML CFP efforts globally?
Yeah, I would think that my recommendations and the way I'm trying to frame this is about it being much broader than the FATF. So I think part of the issue in the counter-terrorist financing space is that we've often conceived of counter-terrorist financing as being only about regulating financial entities or sanctions. In some of the work that I'm doing right now, I've actually identified seven different ways that we do counter-terrorist financing. I won't go through all of them, but I'll talk about a couple of the highlights. So we need to think about this in terms of like a broader toolkit. So of course we've got the criminalization piece. So, you know, criminalizing terrorist financing, but I'm actually not even sure that we're doing that as well as we could be doing, because there are a lot of gaps in how states are criminalizing that. So for instance, do we effectively criminalize the financing of terrorist travel, for instance? There's a number of states around the world where that's a gap. And so it's all of those little pieces that continue to need to be refined and actually need to be evolved over time. The other one that I would say that gets paid, that we don't pay as much attention to, and it is one of the main ways that a lot of states, including NATO or organizations and states, including NATO and the United States, do counter-terrorist financing is through military action. So those kinetic strikes on cash storage sites, capture kill missions of financiers. And this is an important piece of the counter-terrorist financing puzzle, but it also has a lot of externalities in terms of civilian deaths and those kinds of things. And in fact, I would say that all of the ways that we do counter-terrorist financing have a lot of negative externalities associated with it. And I'm not sure that we've actually grappled with all of those as a counter-terrorist financing community. I think that we've kind of glossed over a lot of the human rights implications, the financial implications, all of those kinds of things. And the last one that I want to touch on is the intelligence approach to counter-terrorist financing. So this has been something that's evolved, I would say, a little bit more robustly than other counter-terrorist financing approaches. It's been a bit of a cornerstone of both counterterrorism intelligence and counterterrorist financing for a number of years. But I really think that we've only started to explore the tip of the iceberg in terms of what financial intelligence can do for informing investigations. I think we've also been far too narrow in terms of what we think about financial intelligence. So I have another piece out on explaining what counterterrorist financing or what financial intelligence is. And I try to make the distinction between financial intelligence and financial information. So when we look at mandatory reporting to financial intelligence units, I would argue that a $10,000 large cash transaction report is not financial intelligence. That's financial information. Without context, without additional information, sort of explaining why this is relevant, it's just information that our financial intelligence units hold. Also, financial intelligence can be derived from a lot more than just our financial intelligence units. We focus on that, but financial intelligence units can come from human sources, it can come from signals intelligence, it can increasingly come from open source intelligence now that we've got the wonderful blockchain. You know, we talk a lot about the negative parts of things like Bitcoin, but when you make a ledger public, that actually makes the financial intelligence, or at least financial information piece of it, completely open access, which has enabled a lot more researchers access to the financial intelligence space than before, where it was really constrained to individuals and entities that were associated with states who could collect this kind of information through either covert or overt means. And I think the big thing that I want to say about our current approaches to counter-terrorist financing is that we need to think about all of the ways that we do it. Some of those will apply to the Financial Action Task Force in terms of the recommendations, but a lot of them won't. I can't see the Financial Action Task Force providing recommendations on the use of military force, for instance. I think that that might be a little bit outside of the scope of their mandate, but it is an important part of how we counter the financing of terrorism. And then the last thing that I want to say about this is I think that we really need to have a long, hard look at our regulations and recommendations and best practices and make sure that they're tied directly to observable and proven financing mechanisms. Because we've sort of pulled from the money laundering framework, I think that sometimes our policies and practices in the counter-terrorist financing space are a little misguided, maybe a little overreaching, in some cases, maybe underreaching, if that's a word. So we really need to take a long, hard look at those and also develop flexible and regionally appropriate strategies. Not every country in the world needs to be adopting the same sort of risk profile or even prioritizing particular regulations and legislation in the same way. It really needs to respond to their situation on the ground.
Right. So, Jessica, there is a growing trend of state actors, right, beyond Iran and North Korea that are involved in illicit activities, whether it's cybercrime or evading sanctions or abusing cryptocurrencies. Do you see this manifesting as a more significant threat going forward?
Yes, I would say that this is an evolution that we're seeing in the illicit financing space. All illicit actors that I've looked at, and I had a bit of a broader remit than just terrorist financing was when I was working for the Canadian government, all of them are adopting new tools and technologies. I like to think about them as being learning organizations, but also organizations or illicit actors that reflect broader societal trends. So as we see increased uptake in cryptocurrencies, financial technologies, all of these different ways of moving funds, really, a lot of them are moving funds. As that happens more and more in our societies and cultures, the same thing is happening with illicit organizations. There are obviously huge benefits to a lot of financial technologies, but the scope of change, the pace of change is also a challenge for anyone who's countering these illicit activities, you know, having to stay on top of all of the different technologies that are involved, all of the different vulnerabilities that they represent, all of this really complicates the space. And I would also say that, you know, cybercrime is definitely on the rise. I see this particularly in the terrorist financing space, but amongst all kinds of illicit actors as well, particularly financial frauds. These have a lot of value for illicit actors because they're relatively fast, easy ways to make money that can benefit state actors, non-state actors alike. So we're definitely seeing all of those things. And then in terms of the proliferation of these technologies, a lot of them can be very regionally specific as well. So countries will develop their own financial technologies, which when we're really talking about, when we talk about illicit financing activities, this is a global problem. I don't remember the last time I saw a case that involved just one jurisdiction. These are transnational problems. So the proliferation of those technologies, how regionally focused they can be, also can complicate investigations and make countering this activity much more difficult.
Right. So, moving back to the FATF, you know, they recently published a report on ethnically or racially motivated terrorism financing. What is your understanding of the threat by these smaller actors? And, you know, is there adequate priority according to them in either national or global counterterrorism efforts?
I think a lot of these actors present sort of new counterterrorism or countering violent extremist challenges because a lot of them lack the organizational structure that we're used to. This can make it more difficult, especially when our tools are really designed to tackle those organizations. So we're quite used to using our counterterrorist financing tools to tackle Al-Qaeda that has this organizational structure, maybe like management committees, they're storing money in a variety of different ways. When we look at ethnically or racially motivated actors, it looks really different than that. Some of those mechanisms are still at play. We do see them, but I would say that it's smaller in terms of scope and scale, or at least what we're seeing so far has been smaller in terms of scope and scale. I will put a little asterisk or caveat there saying that, you know, sometimes we just miss a lot of things. So it may seem like it's smaller in scale until we realize that, you know, we've had this massive blind spot. So I think that we need to all be alive to the idea that, for instance, there could be some state sponsorship of some of these individuals or groups, particularly the ideologues. Even though we have very little evidence of that, I think it's important to stay alive to the possibility and be looking for indicators of that kind of activity. And I think part of the issue here too is that, you know, some of the states that are involved or most involved, most active in the counter-terrorist financing space or counter-terrorism space are also the states that are active exporters or homes for a lot of these ideologies. So when we look at things like the United States and Canada and Australia and Europe, you know, we've all been very active in the counter-terrorist financing space, but a lot of these countries are also places where the racist and ethnically motivated violent extremists are coming from, where they're developing their ideologies, where they have freedom of movement. And so I think that we've been a little bit hesitant to use some of our counterterrorism tools against them, and particularly our counterterrorist financing tools. But from my perspective, this is also important in terms of getting ahead of the threat. So we need to use these tools, particularly our financial intelligence tools, to get ahead of the threat, to look for things like intent, capability, planning and preparation, all of the changes in behavior that occur before terrorist events. And financial intelligence can tell you an awful lot about this, you know, because a lot of actors will have plenty of intent to conduct some sort of terrorist attack, but without capability, without the ability to buy the materials, to buy the weapons, they're going to be really restricted to a super small scale lone actor attack, which can still be lethal. Don't get me wrong, you know, that can still involve things like stabbing attacks or vehicle ramming attacks that can kill a couple of people, sometimes hundreds of people if you get really unlucky. But it's a bit of a different scope and scale from improvised explosive devices or multiple attackers conducting firearms attacks, for instance. So we really need to be using our financial intelligence tools to get ahead of some of those threats. I will say, though, that over the last few months, we've definitely been seeing more disruption activities. You know, I'm thinking really about preemptive arrests in this space. And I think that this is really good and important. And it demonstrates to me that some states are, in fact, able to get ahead of the threat. I think that my concern still remains whether we're devoting enough resources to detecting and deterring these threats. And I think that we're still on the no side of that equation. And then finally, I think that we really need to exploit that financial intelligence to look at the relationships between individuals in different countries and understand the scope and scale of what we can really conceive of as a movement, but where there are those financial relationships, where they do seem to be existing.
Right. Okay. So, you know, Jessica, you are an accomplished author. Let's speak a bit about your books now. So, you know, your book entitled Women and Modern Terrorism, how did that come about? What was the main motivation for you to research this topic? And also, what kind of challenges did you encounter while putting together data and evidence for your book?
Yeah, thanks for asking me about that. That was, so Women in Modern Terrorism is my first book. I wrote that really over the course of, I think, about a 10-year period. So it started off when I was finishing my master's degree at the Royal Military College of Canada. I had done a fair bit of work sort of on the topic, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with it, but I had started to accumulate a data set because I'd noticed that when I looked at existing data sets at the time, which were far more limited than they are now, none of them disaggregated the data based on gender. And then I was also at the same time starting to see like some really interesting gendered language around women's involvement in terrorist activity. You know, some of it really emphasizing the personal motivations for women's involvement. You know, a common refrain would be that when men conducted a terrorist attack, we would talk about their political objectives and what they wanted to achieve politically. And then when women did it, we would talk about how they'd suffered sexual violence or how they'd lost a family member. And for me, this really seemed like a very incomplete way to think about this. I think now I would frame it as both men and women have a combination of personal and political motives when they engage in political violence. But at the time, we didn't really have a lot of language to sort of describe that. So I wanted to unpack the phenomena of women in terrorism, understand really just the basics of it, the numbers that are involved. I like to quantify problems as a starting point to really get a sense. I think that's a great place to start when you're thinking about something. And so I just started to compile a data set over time, over about the period of 10 years. And then at one point in time, I just realized, you know, I could compile this thing forever, but it wasn't seeing the light of day. So I decided to write a book. I was very fortunate. I was working for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service at the time, and there wasn't a huge historical publication record for a lot of the people that worked there. You know, there's a lot of sensitivities, obviously, when government employees, and particularly those in sensitive positions, want to publish public papers. But I was very fortunate that they were very supportive, helpful, of course, that it wasn't my area of research for the service. And so really, over many airplane rides, long trips, long work-related travel, I managed to write this manuscript. And so my main motivation was really to shed light on the phenomena, challenge some of the assumptions that we were seeing in the literature, particularly around women's involvement, explain how even if women are rarely actors in the political violence space, it's still important to think about them from a counterterrorism perspective as well. You know, it's not sufficient to say, well, only 3 out of 10 terrorists are women, so we can just ignore them and focus on the other 7. And really 30% of the terrorist attacks proceed. Like, that's not a good way to do counterterrorism. So challenging some of those assumptions. And then just from the data and evidence perspective, this was such an interesting problem because on one hand, I found that terrorist attacks perpetrated by women were more likely to receive media attention in some contexts. So I was able to find the information more easily. And then in other contexts, they were really downplaying the role of women. And so it was harder to find the information on women's involvement. So I really had to rely on largely suicide attacks by women, although also other kinds of attacks, like it could have been a bombing attack or other types of terrorism perpetrated by women, but like real like kinetic terrorist incidents from women in order to form sort of that base understanding of what their rate of involvement is, which obviously is just the tip of the iceberg because women are involved in so many more aspects of terrorism than just as I like to call it, the bomb throwers or the terrorist attackers. Particularly the more I delve into it, the more I see them in the financing space. So that's sort of the high level explanation of where the book came from and why I wanted to write it.
Excellent. And I think you also have another book on the way, which is due to be released in a few days. That's going to be called Illicit Money, Financing Terrorism in the 21st Century. Again, for that one, what was the motivation? What were the challenges that you encountered? And can you give us a bit of a sneak peek into this book, before it gets released?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, kind of like the Women in Terrorism book, I was really struck by some of the assumptions that were being made in the literature on terrorist financing. There was also a strange disconnect between the terrorist financing literature and the counter-terrorist financing literature, in which they didn't kind of speak to each other all that much. So we'd have researchers exploring the mechanisms of financing within groups, for particular attacks, for particular organizations. And they would sometimes include some decent policy recommendations for counterterrorism. And then there was a whole other subset of literature on counter-terrorist financing that really just talked about the high-level legislation or the international regulations and norms without tying it directly to the financing activity that we were seeing in the other literature. So I saw this disconnect and thought, okay, first of all, we need to bring these two things closer together. And the second thing is the assumptions even in the terrorism literature were, or the terrorist financing literature were from a practitioner's perspective, I found counterproductive. So for instance, there's a lot of emphasis on revenue generation for terrorist organizations as sort of the sum total of financing activities. But that's actually only one very small piece of financing. And I'll talk about that a little bit more when I explain sort of the sneak peek into the new book. But when we think about financing, we need to think about how they're using money, how they're moving money, how they're storing and managing it, how they're obscuring it, because all of these little different aspects of the mechanisms involved present different counter-terrorist financing opportunities. So I really wanted to disaggregate that and expand what we think of when we think about financing. That was one of the main assumptions that I wanted to get into. The data and evidence for this were really, really difficult. So, you know, I don't want to downplay the book. My publishers would not want me to sell the book short, but there are a lot of limitations when I looked at this data. And collecting good data on terrorist financing is a painstaking process. So it's not the kind of thing, if I wanted to develop sort of a macro level overview, I couldn't recreate data. I had to sort of use what was available to sort of explain what we know and what we think we know so far. But there are gaps that you can drive trucks through because, you know, a lot of the information that we're relying on is coming from states. A lot of that information can be politicized, especially when we start talking about states that have been put on the FATF gray or black lists. You know, they have a vested interest in releasing particular types of information, maybe not others. So there's a huge amount of politicization that goes into the reporting about terrorist financing. Also, you have the involvement of states in financing terrorism. You have the involvement of intelligence services in financing terrorism. So all of these things really compound the challenges of collecting good data and good evidence. So those were some of the challenges. I could probably go on quite at length about that, but you have asked for a bit of a sneak peek into the book. So I think one of the big things that I'm trying to do in the book is really disaggregate the idea of operational and organizational financing. So I would say that since 9/11, maybe before 9/11, although I think this approach really solidified after 9/11, we've really focused on countering group level financing. So how do we stop the Al-Qaeda's, the Islamic States, the Abu Sayyaf's of the world from getting money? Which is important, obviously. Organizations are the ones who drive terrorist attacks for the most part. But there's also a lot of difference, especially now, between how an organization finances itself and how a terrorist cell or even an individual finances their attacks. The scope and scale is really significantly different. A lot of attacks today are self-financed, either for cells or for individuals. It's actually fairly rare that you see a terrorist organization funding an attack. Most cells and individuals are expected to self-finance that activity, to the point that we even see that kind of differentiation in with ISIL-KP in Afghanistan, where their smaller cell, the smaller operational units are expected to sort of self-finance a lot of their activities. So I wanted to make that distinction because I think that this is one of the places where we maybe have a disconnect between financing mechanisms and the policies and practices that we're applying to them. And of course, not every approach to counter-terrorist financing applies equally to cells, individuals, and organizations. So that's a big emphasis. So every chapter, I'm sort of walking through the mechanisms and how they apply in these different spaces. So I think that's a pretty significant contribution. I'm not the first one to do that, obviously. I'm building on a lot of really good work that has made that distinction, but I think I'm one of the first ones who's really made it really concrete when I look at every mechanism of financing. So that's the second piece, is that I've really expanded our analysis of those mechanisms. So I mentioned this earlier in our interview that we talk a lot about how terrorist organizations and cells and individuals raise money, but I think that financing is about so much more. It's about how they use money. So are they buying their weapons and components online? Are they buying drones from particular countries? So it's all that use of money is critical when you're talking about an organization that controls territory? What are they spending money on? Like, what social services are they providing? How much does that cost? Because that affects where other parts of their budget are. Like, if they're spending a ton of money on social services, they're not going to have as much money to devote to actual terrorist operations. How they're moving money is critical. This has gotten a fair bit of attention in the terrorist financing literature. We could talk at length about the role of money service businesses, hawalas, and banks in moving money for terrorists and increasingly now cryptocurrency. But I'll go through that a fair bit more, especially on the operational side of things, because we see a lot less money movement there. My big takeaway on the movement side, though, is, you know, we're still talking about banks and we're still talking about cash couriers 20 years after 9/11. These are still really important parts of the money movement mechanism. And then there are three other aspects that I think get far less attention in the literature and amongst practitioners. And it's how terrorist organizations, cells, and individuals manage, store, and obscure their funds. So obviously, when a terrorist group is raising millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, they have to manage that money. So how are they doing it? Are they doing it? Is one person in control of that money? Is it a committee of individuals? Have they decentralized that? Because again, all of this presents different counter-terrorist financing opportunities. If it's one person, well then, you know, a capture-kill mission against that one individual may be pretty effective. But if it's not one person, you may have a lot of other externalities you have to contend with. But even cells and individuals manage money for their attacks. So I did an interesting article a while ago on the disrupted terrorist plot of the Toronto 18 here in Canada. And there was a real clear pattern of one of the cell leaders, you know, figuring out how much the whole plot would cost, identifying ways to raise the money, who is going to do what pieces of component acquisition, and even managing the operational security measures, such that he printed up business cards, declaring them to be student farmers so that they could have a cover story for buying the fertilizers that they were planning on using for their bombs. So like this is all of the management of the funds and the operational security measures. That's also so interesting. The storage of funds, I think, is also under-examined, particularly in the literature, but still amongst practitioners. When we're talking about terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, like the Islamic State, like Taliban, like Al-Qaeda, like Islamic State, Khorasan Province, they're raising a fair bit of money. Where are they storing it? Some of them are making investments in real estate, businesses, that kind of thing. So identifying those is obviously critical from a counter-terrorist financing perspective. Great opportunities for disruption there. Are they holding it in bank accounts? Are they holding the money with hawaladars? Like all of these things, figuring out where they're storing their money, again, more opportunities. The more nuance we can really get into with these mechanisms, the more opportunities we have for disruption. So those are the expanded analysis of the mechanisms involved. And in terms of obscuring, I just sort of go through some of the financial tradecraft that we'd be pretty familiar with if you're into the money laundering piece of things at all. And then there are a few other ways that terrorists do it that are a bit different. And then the other few contributions I think that this book makes, you know, really emphasizing terrain analysis to predict terrorist financing methods. So sometimes as terrorist financing analysts or practitioners, we're confronted with a new group or a new type of issue. And so how do we figure out how terrorists or illicit actors are going to finance those activities? You have to look at the terrain that they're operating in. So basically, the long and short of the story is that illicit actors will make use of the economic activity in their area of control or influence. If there's a lot of economic activity happening online, they will do a lot of activity online. If it's a cash-based economy, their activities will be cash-based. So just really understanding the economic terrain is a key piece of being able to predict some of those methods. And the last two pieces, you know, I think I've talked about this already, but trying to quantify our approach to terrorist financing. So I went through and I really looked at all of the different mechanisms that about 50 different groups use, and again, 50 different plots and attacks use, to try to give us some sort of baseline. Like, so how often are banks used by terrorist organizations to move money? So I basically just counted it up, give us some base understanding from which we can measure change over time, measure, maybe think about starting to measure some of the effectiveness of our policies, and just starting to have a quantified conversation about this instead of saying, well, a lot of terrorist groups use Hawala. Okay, well, what does a lot mean? A lot of terrorist terrorist attacks have been funded or have used cash couriers. Okay, so what do we mean by a lot? Can we be specific? Can we be precise? And sort of use that to guide policy development and then our evaluation of those policies. And the last piece, and I have mentioned this already, is just incorporating a bit of a gender analysis into our understanding of terrorist financing. So really pulling from that women in terrorism knowledge base to explain how terrorist organizations, cells and individuals recruit, use, you know, instrumentalize women and their involvement in terrorism. A lot of it, again, through acting as financial facilitators. Sometimes this is part of financial tradecraft. So terrorists using female names or female nominees or proxies to hide male involvement in activities, assuming that counterterrorism practitioners will be less suspicious about female names. And just all of that and sort of the hidden role of women within terrorist organizations and how often it's about that background logistics and financial support. So that's really the overarching contributions that I'm trying to make with this book. And I have actually summarized them in one of my newsletters. So listeners can look that up. My Substack is Insight Intelligence, and you can find that summary there if you're interested in knowing more before you commit to buying the book.
Well, the book sounds like it's going to be a fantastic read. I will make sure that this link, which you mentioned, is put in the text within the video as well, so that people can see it. All the best for the book launch, and you know, I'm sure it's going to do well, and it's, you know, be very, very interesting for people to read. So Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for sharing your time, your thoughts. Thanks for the effort in doing this. It was a fantastic listening to you.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.